The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payden for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service. Our first article was published on August 15 and written by Jack Jenkins, entitled Pastor Indicted Alongside Trump in Georgia Election Meddling Case. The latest chapter in Donald Trump's ongoing legal drama played out on the evening of August 14, as a grand jury in Georgia indicted the former president and 18 others as part of a sweeping probe of alleged efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election in the state. While most of those indicted are lawyers or people with close connections to Trump, at least one is a faith leader, an Illinois pastor and former police chaplain charged in connection with efforts to intimidate Georgia election workers. The indictment singles out the Reverend Stephen Clifford Lee, a pastor within the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod denomination, alleging that he and 18 others unlawfully conspired and endeavored to conduct and participate in criminal enterprise in Fulton County, Georgia, and elsewhere. Among the specific charges levied against Lee, attempting to influence witnesses and conspiring to solicit false statements and writings. Lee's involvement revolves around his efforts to contact Georgia election worker Ruby Freeman in December 2020. Lee appeared at the election worker's door roughly 2 weeks after Freeman and her daughter, Wandrea Shay Moss, were falsely accused by Trump of pulling fake ballots from suitcases in Georgia, with Trump suggesting they committed election fraud. According to the indictment and Reuters reporting, Lee knocked on Freeman's door, left, and later parked his car in her driveway. Alarmed, Freeman called the police. Police body cam footage uncovered last year by Reuters shows an officer approaching Lee's car, at which point Lee identified himself as a faith leader. I'm a pastor, and I'm also working with some folks who are trying to help Ruby out, and also get to some truth of what's going on, Lee says in the video. Lee acknowledged that he had knocked on Freeman's door, noting he is also prior law enforcement, saying he was a sergeant out in California. According to Reuters, Lee served as a police officer in California and provided chaplaincy support to police officers in places such as New York City. However, an NYPD spokesperson clarified to RNS that Lee has not been employed as an NYPD chaplain. Later in the body cam video, Lee encouraged the officers to let him speak with the election worker, suggesting he and his cohorts have some pro bono service for her. According to Reuters, Freeman responded to the offer in a separate body cam video. "I'm not interested," she said. She later added, "I have a pastor." The indictment alleges the door-knocking incident was part of a broader effort to influence Freeman's testimony in an official proceeding in Fulton County, Georgia, concerning the November 3, 2020 presidential election in Georgia. Prosecutors allege Lee worked with Willie Lewis Floyd III, the head of Black Voices for Trump, and publicist Trevian Cuddy to try to influence Freeman. Floyd and Cuddy are also among those indicted. According to the indictment, Lee contacted Floyd after Freeman rejected his offer, with Lee allegedly telling Floyd the election worker wouldn't talk to him because he was white. Their efforts culminated a few weeks later, on January 4, 2021, when Cuddy met with Freeman. The Chicago-based publicist, who also represented rapper and vocal Trump supporter Ye, threatened Freeman with jail time unless she provided information on election fraud. The meeting was also captured on police body cam footage. Up until at least this weekend, Lee served Living Word Lutheran Church in Orland Park, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. He preached at the church as recently as August 13, when he delivered a sermon focused on the book of Job. Reached by RNS on Tuesday, August 15, a representative for Living Word said Lee was working at the church in an interim capacity, but is no longer the pastor. The representative declined to offer any statement regarding Lee's indictment. Mike Baer, head of communications for the LCMS, confirmed that Lee is a pastor in the denomination, but described him as retired, saying his status is emeritus. Baer declined to discuss the indictment, citing a policy of not commenting on ongoing investigations. Freeman's daughter, Moss, testified last year before the U.S. House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the United States Capitol. The committee also released Freeman's full testimony on the topic. "I've always believed it when God says he will make your name great, but this is not the way it was supposed to be," Freeman said. Our next article, published on August 15th, is entitled, "This India Day, Indian Americans Want to Be Independent from Politics," by Risha Karmarkar. Edison, New Jersey, home to the highest concentration of Indian Americans in the nation, and often referred to as Little India by outsiders and natives alike, has been the hub for India Day celebrations for years. This year was no exception. Crowds gathered on Sunday, August 13, in an advance celebration of the August 15 anniversary of India's independence from Britain in 1947. Loud music, vibrant flags, traditional costumes, and even the Hindu deities Ram and Hanuman colored the streets of Edison. Businesses and temples passed out lassis and prasad. In the United States, where 4.4 million people of Indian heritage reside, Indian Independence Day is a recognition of freedom, a multi-faith, multicultural celebration of Indian civilization before and after the British Raj. But for many Indian Americans today, celebrating India Day comes with the complicated decision of whether to celebrate, ignore, or protest their ancestral homeland's current political atmosphere and the rise of Hindu nationalism there. A bulldozer at last year's parade in Edison stirred controversy and brought a spotlight to the political tensions simmering under the surface of India's diaspora. The bulldozer, adorned with photos of Indian politician Yogi Adityanath, offended many Indian American Muslims who felt the bulldozer's presence was a form of intimidation linked to the razing of Muslim homes in Uttar Pradesh. The Indian Business Association issued a statement apologizing for the bulldozer, calling it a divisive image that did not reflect the mission of the IBA or its India Day parade. But for some scholars and activists, the presence at this year's parade of groups connected to India's Bharatiya Janata Party signaled the event remained a political statement. "That's missing the point," according to Jay Bansal, Vice President of Education for the VHPA, also known as the World Hindu Council. "India is 80% Hindus. And if 80% of society develops a certain amount of pride in their heritage and in their civilizational contributions at large, why should it threaten anyone?" said Bansal. Indian pride, he said, is a right that has been denied to Indians time and time again by outside influences. When we celebrate Independence Day, it's not celebrating a political event. It's celebrating freedom from centuries of subjugation by foreigners, Bansal said. Ganesh Ramakrishnan, the Northeast Outreach Director for the HSS, said a parade like this is the perfect way to bring the diverse Indian community together, especially in this digital age where Indians seem divided along political lines. Youth and young adults in the HSS marched on April 13 with placards highlighting the sociocultural organization's messages: service to humanity, service to divinity, God bless America, God bless India, and universal oneness. Political ideologies can separate people, but philosophies are deeper, broader, and more spiritual, said Ramakrishnan. This parade was echoing all of those sentiments. But many in the diaspora hope to shift the messaging this year, to see Indian Americans, the highest earning ethnic group in the U.S., be recognized for their contributions to society, not their country's politics. Another India Day celebration a few hundred miles away at the U.S. Capitol also took place on August 13 to mark the 76th anniversary of India's independence. And while the turnout at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington was not near that of Edison, the message was clear: India is for all Indians. Mike Gauss, founder and president of the nonprofit Center for Pluralism, introduced the event as one to celebrate an inclusive India, a civilization that, he says, was the first in the universe to embrace religious diversity. India has always welcomed everyone. We have learned to live with each other for a long time, said Gauss. There is a lot of happiness when we come together. That is the joy all Indians deserve. An Indian American Muslim, Gauss organized the event for Indians of any cultural or religious background to sing patriotic Indian songs. His mission, he says, is to develop positive patriotism among Indians by reminding them of the nation's homegrown plurality. Over 200 languages are spoken in India, as well as thousands of dialects. In addition, Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Buddhists, Jains, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and atheists all call India home. Humility builds bridges, said Gauss. We are created to be different. If by nature we are diverse, we must also be diverse in our faiths. Priya Kathari moved to Maryland just 1 year ago from her home in India, where she ran a nonprofit helping women start small businesses. She says she was grateful to find family here after leaving her own family. It's a very proud moment for me to stand here, opposite the Lincoln Memorial, to talk about India and the celebration of Indian Independence Day, said Kathari. One of the best parts is that I'm a part of this. Now, an opinion piece that was published on August 18, entitled "Why Christian Nationalism Makes American Christians Less Christ-like," written by Andrew Whitehead, who is Associate Professor of Sociology at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, where he co-directs the Association of Religion Data Archives. Growing up in a primarily white, conservative Christian community, I repeatedly heard warnings concerning what was going to destroy our Christian faith and the United States with it. Feminism, divorce, homosexuality, secularism, or non-Christian faiths. In presidential election years, these threats become even more acute. Leaders instructed us to vote our values and ensure God's blessing on the United States by placing the right people in positions of power to turn our nation back to God. Many well-meaning and earnest Christians, like myself, fell in line and did what we felt we had to do in order to return the U.S. to its Christian roots. It was in this context I was taught to love Jesus, love my neighbor, and seek to do God's will. Being a good American meant being a good Christian, and being a good Christian meant accepting the correct beliefs, caring for those around you, standing up for what is right, and advocating for our Christian convictions in the public square. By doing these things, we could help the dangers threatening America stay at bay. But what if we were wrong? not about the importance of living our faith out every day at home and in the public square, but about the nature of the threats facing our country. What if the greatest danger to the witness of Christianity in the United States wasn't any of those outside threats? What if the danger was closer to home and looked so familiar that it was able to evade detection? After years of examining Christian nationalism as a social scientist, I'm convinced the greatest threat to Christianity in the U.S. is not outside forces. Instead, it is white Christian nationalism. Over and over, I find evidence that the practical fruit of Christian nationalism is not love. It is power, control, domination, fear, and violence. Christian nationalism makes American Christians less Christ-like. Here's what I mean. White Christian nationalism is a cultural framework asserting that civic life in the United States should be organized according to a particular form of conservative Christianity. In addition to the standard Christian religious and theological beliefs, Christian nationalism brings with it a host of cultural assumptions about who really matters and who should be in charge of life in the U.S., primarily white Christian citizens. Christian nationalism is not interested in a government for the people, by the people, but rather for a particular people, by a particular people. Christian nationalism weakens the church by demanding it seek earthly, self-interested power, rather than seeking to support and serve the marginalized. Central to Christian nationalism are three idols that make promises of protection and provision to American Christians and require allegiance: power, fear, and violence. These three idols co-opt our theological imaginations and distort our knowledge of God and neighbor. They lead us to betray our loyalty to Jesus and the gospel. Power is the ability to get others to do what you want despite their resistance. Wielding power to serve one's own group is tempting, especially when facing the political realities of living in a pluralistic democratic society where collaboration and compromise are vital. But when it comes down to democracy or power, white Christian nationalism chooses power every time. Fear and a sense of threat, the second idol, focuses on a perceived loss of privileged access to power. It seeks to protect the people like us against them. It urges Christians to fear their neighbors, those with different skin color, nationality, or religious belief, rather than love them. Violence is a third idol of Christian nationalism. It is intimately intertwined with worshiping power and demonizing others through fear. When the fires of fear and threat are constantly stoked because they are out to steal our rightful power, violence is a natural result. But the use of violence against our neighbors signals a distrust of the Word of God in the world and seeing the image of God in all people. This weakens the church by building up dividing walls of hostility rather than breaking them down. Two clear examples of these three idols are our country's continued struggle with racism and xenophobia. Christian nationalism weakens the church and threatens democracy by blinding us to the cries of those speaking out against social inequality. It obscures the structural and systemic causes of racial inequality. And because it claims that the United States has a special relationship with the Christian God, any criticism of America is seen as an attack on God and the Christian faith. Ironically, the Bible itself is filled with criticism of God's people when they fail to live up to God's commands, and especially when they mistreat their neighbors. I am convinced that we can all, whether Christian or not, recognize that Christian nationalism only leads to harm for our neighbors and betrays more loving expressions of the Christian gospel. As Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. showed us, we are caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Injustice experienced by one community is injustice experienced by all. When Jesus came, he preached the kingdom of God and a gospel that was good news to the poor, oppressed, and imprisoned. Luke 4:16-21. He was not only talking about our personal salvation, but about abundant life for everyone. Once we see the gospel as good news for the present, good news for the marginalized, good news for the prisoner, good news for the poor, good news for the blind, and good news for the oppressed, we can begin to take the evidence that social science hands us about Christian nationalism and recognize that this ideology limits, and in many cases outright opposes, the work Jesus claimed he came to do and commanded us to do likewise. Matthew 22:37-40. Love the Lord your God, love your neighbor as yourself. I have long wrestled with the implications of Christian nationalism for Christianity, both professionally and in my own faith journey. I hope the American church can move toward expressions of Christianity that allow it to regain its prophetic voice and no longer make it the servant of one particular vision for this nation. By confronting Christian nationalism in our midst, we can journey toward a future where everyone is allowed to flourish. Our last piece is an excerpt from an article published on the 14th of August, written by Jana Rice, and entitled Joseph F. Smith, a Traumatized and Beloved Mormon Leader. In 2000 and 2001, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints focused its worldwide curriculum on the teachings of Joseph F. Smith, or JFS, who lived from 1838 to 1918, a nephew of the founding prophet Joseph Smith, Jr. JFS was the church's sixth president. An entire lesson in the manual was devoted to the wrongful path of abuse, quoting JFS at length about how violence was unthinkable, and praising him as a tender and gentle man who expressed sorrow at any kind of abuse. He understood that violence would beget violence, and his own life was an honest expression of compassion and patience, warmth and understanding. The lesson's claim is not wholly untrue, as historian Stephen Tresham points out in the afterword of his monumental biography of JFS, Like a Fiery Meteor. But it's certainly selective, since JFS admitted in divorce affidavits to beating his first wife, Levera, in the 1860s. The only part he disputed was whether he'd attacked her with a rope or a small stick. He also verbally abused and threatened her, at one point saying he ought to drill a hole in her head and fill it with manure. JFS is on record for beating a neighbor almost to death in 1873. There were other stories, too, with less clear evidence, including a possible beating of his little sister's teacher when he was still in his early teens. JFS was a turbulent man who admitted that his temper was the worst part of him and that the only man on earth he ever feared was himself. But the tender side was there as well, especially toward children. Orphaned at a young age, his father, Hiram, was murdered in the Carthage jail in 1844, and his mother died when he was a teen, JFS never lost his sympathy for other orphans. He went out of his way to help and even adopt children in need. There's also no record that JFS was ever violent toward his five subsequent plural wives after Levera. Both responses, the violence and the compassion, stem from the same early trauma, Tayson said in a Zoom interview. There was always this constant sense that he was going to lose everything that he cherished, said Tayson, an associate professor at Cleveland State University, who has researched JFS for over a decade. Taysom points out that JFS's trauma didn't end with his father's murder, but was followed by many other deaths. His mother, Mary Fielding Smith, died when he was 13. As an adult, he buried 13 of his own 45 children, losses that JFS grieved desperately. "That always drove him," Taysom said. "I'm sure that's the source of the anger that comes out in him. He doesn't have great control over the ferocious emotions that he has, whether it's rage or the grief that he feels for losing a child. He either can't control it or doesn't control it, which is different from a lot of people in this world." Even in that context of the 19th century American West, very few people in the church hierarchy would have been as prone to violence as he was. I'm not a psychologist, but the inability to regulate strong emotion can be a hallmark of a traumatized person. He definitely had that. Another response was JFS's unwavering, even fundamentalist, religiosity. In the face of ongoing trauma and poverty, he came to see the church as a holy refuge to be protected at all costs. "He's unapologetically dualistic in the way he views the world," said Taysom. "He sees everything as either building up the kingdom or destroying it. He sees the world as this dangerous place that kills righteous things." This meant he could be hard on other people just as he was hard on himself. Despite his deep love for his family, for example, he sometimes subjected them to biting criticism and nearly impossible standards. "I never encountered him asking forgiveness for someone or apologizing for something. It just wasn't part of who he was," Taysom said. His craving for tidy systems forever changed the previously more haphazard administration of the church. He brought the first presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve together in purpose. The power struggles between those two bodies are an interesting thread in the book, and foreclosed for all time the possibility of a succession crisis of the sort that had pertained after the death of Joseph Smith Jr., and to a lesser extent, after the deaths of Brigham Young and John Taylor. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen next time. I'm Mary Grace Payden, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.